So welcome to This Cycling Life. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Paul Farrell, a longtime entrepreneur and I think real innovator in the cycling industry. Paul grew up in the UK, but found his way to Australia in the 1980s, where he actually launched the first full Australian composite bike business at that time, Leggera, which in Italian means light. Paul, I believe you can correct me. So what we're going to do is jump right in the interview and focus really on this life of an incredible entrepreneur. So Paul, maybe you can start by telling us a little bit about your childhood and where this passion for bikes started.
A long time ago. I'm in my mid-60s now, so you're going back a long time. So the memory's a bit, not that good. But basically, I was born and grew up in North London, very close to Grand Union Canal, which is an old Victorian waterway used for moving coal. And also a very convenient place to dump stolen bicycles, which in the 60s seemed to be almost a passion, like, going down the pub and getting drunk. People would just borrow a bike and use it right in the canal. I was very, very lucky that my father was an engineer. He worked for General Motors and then he worked for Atlas Copco. So I sort of grew up in an environment where we had a shed in our backyard and it was full of tools, most of which I ended up losing or breaking, much to his displeasure. But I fished out a couple of old bikes completely by accident one day, brought them home, and I was very, very fortunate that my next door neighbour was a panel beater and sprayer. So he said to me, if you can take them apart, learn how to take a bike apart, we'll get it all restored. I'll paint it for you. You can rebuild it, learn how to rebuild it, and if you can sell it. Which, looking back, I suppose was completely illegal. I should have taken it to the police station, but anyway, well, that's a long time ago. They're probably still looking for me. Anyway, so that's how it started, and I did that, and I had a little paper round, as everybody used to do in those days when newspapers were things made of paper, and all my pocket money used to go into that. And I used to ride the bikes that I had, and then people would like them, and basically either give them away or get onto the new one. So at that stage, I learned about bottom brackets and how to lace a wheel and, the difference between different brake setups. So that's really how it started. But it was never, ever on my list as going to be a career by any means.
That's interesting. You did actually, you went off then and studied and went quite the other direction from bicycles because you became a geophysicist. And I understand then you got into kind of oil exploration world.
Correct.
So you went off this quite a long period in your life as a geophysicist. And then, as I understand it, you found yourself off to Brisbane in the early 1980s with the intention of some sort of semi-retirement. Then you were back in the bike world. So how did that rekindling of cycling come about and then becoming an entrepreneur in the cycling business?
One word, boredom. Boredom. In 1984, I ended up in Australia, being British, public school upbringing. I didn't want to go to Australia. I was posted there by the oil exploration company I was then working for. And having a great life, I was still single. I was traveling the world. I was in the oil exploration business, which was back then was really quite adventurous, and we got to see a lot of places. I've lived in over 50 countries of the world, and most of them places where you find oil. So a lot in the Middle East, Africa, West Africa, Nigeria, Ended up in Australia, thinking the absolute worst, thinking I'd be met at the airport by a guy in a...
What do you mean the absolute worst, Paul? I mean, Australia's a marvelous place, you know?
It is. An English public school boy, I was absolutely distraught. I said, there's no way you'll get me out to that fly-infested place. So I literally landed at Adelaide Airport in 1979, expecting there to be a tin shed with a Toyota Land Cruiser and a guy with a dead kangaroo across the bull bar. That's what I thought of Australia. And I ended up loving the place. I lived there in the end for 21 years. I was married. I was married to an Australian lady. I had two beautiful Australian daughters. eventually ended up leaving that company, setting up my own exploration company, and made, to be polite about it, a shed load of money. So I retired quite early. I think I was 34, 35. Moved to the Gold Coast, which for your listeners who don't know what that is, it's like a Miami Dade County without the drugs and guns. And and I had a wonderful lifetime there. So I was now in my 40s. I'd started and done some very, very strange investments in various businesses. Some had worked, some hadn't worked. But I found myself in China, as many people do, in the late 90s at the world's largest trade show, which is held every year in Shenzhen. And my wife at the time was with me, and I was incredibly bored with what we were doing at the time. And she said, just go up and have a coffee somewhere. You're really bugging me. So I sat down, and on the table beside me was the TBS, the Taiwan Bike Guide, and which is a very thick document, as you know, with all the manufacturers in Asia. So I started leaping through it and started seeing all this stuff. Now, I went back to Australia, and I'd actually bought a Look graphite bike many years before. It was offered it to me, and some guy couldn't afford to keep it or something. I can't remember the circumstances. It's a lovely bike, way better than I was ever a rider. But riding it around, people used to stop me and say, well, that's a nice looking bike. What's it made of? Graphite. No idea what it is. And that is it, zip wheels on it. That was an even more strange idea. So I decided, somebody said, well, why don't you join one of the, there were two clubs, the Gold Stars and the Cats. I ended up joining the Gold Stars. It happened to be where some of the European pros were in the Cats. So I started riding that. And then I bought a Trek OCLV just to see what that was like. That was a great bike as well. This was late 90s. And then having seen the TBS, I decided, wouldn't it be fun to go to Taiwan and look at the industry? So I did. I made a few phone calls, jumped on a plane, came up here, and visited a lot of factories. And by the time I went from Taipei, which is in the north of Taiwan, to the very south, Kaohsiung, and that was in the days before the current high-speed rail. It was an old rickety train. It used to take ages. I had accumulated, I think, five taxi loads of samples, which I then excess baggage back to Australia and sold them to my club friends in about 3 hours. Got back on a plane, came back, and the rest, as I say, is history. So initially, I was just bringing in.
That was interesting. Obviously, up until that period, sorry to cut you off there, Paul, but I can tell when you get started with your stories, if I let you go, you're going to keep going, mate. So I'm going to jump in from time to time, you know, to bring up
me when you want.
But it was a very interesting period, right? Because, you know, like right up until that period of the 1980s, obviously, you know, steel had been dominating. The industry had been really, you know, dominated by the Europeans, you know, the Italians, the French, to an extent the Germans. And we did see then in the sort of 1980s the rise of the American bicycle manufacturers, and then of course the Japanese with Shimano, later followed by the Taiwanese. So you were one of the, certainly for Australia, but probably internationally, you were one of the first, I guess, really to start to understand the opportunity of the OEM market, which were these companies in Taiwan producing product which were not branded under their own labels.
That's correct.
Did you really appreciate what, I mean, because at the same time, you know, a lot of the German, French, Italian companies were focused more on how to compete with the Japanese and later the Taiwanese as opposed to collaborate with them. What was the mindset that you saw in the industry at that time? What was the attitude of the Europeans towards the Asian producers?
Well, first of all, at that time, I was completely and utterly naive about that. You know, I hadn't ever invested in actual pure manufacturing. My businesses have been very, very, very wide-ranging, everything from tourism to household products. I mean, I invested in a lot of different companies. So I was incredibly naive about manufacturing when I came. I had no real idea how the industry worked, as many people haven't. But I certainly wasn't a pioneer. Mike Senior and Specialized have done basically the same, you know, five, God knows how many years before I did. I just happened to be from Australia and was one of the first. And the reason I wanted to do it wasn't just to be in the bike industry. I had a very specific goal of being in the composite bike industry because I believe wholeheartedly that was going to be the future of bicycles. We've been through the steel age, we've been through the alloy cycle, excuse me, that's the pun, period. And now it was very obvious to me just by the reaction I was getting going to the race. I was always the guy that was picked because I had the most expensive bike, most exotic bike, even though I was probably the worst rider. But it was just assumed because I had an expensive bike, it must be good. No, I just happened to have the money to spend on that. But I could see that there was a desire for people to make that change. So if I have any talent at all, it was just predicting the future direction that the cycling industry would go, and I exploited that.
Because even at that time, I mean, you mentioned Mike Sinyard actually from Specialized as one of the real pioneers. I mean, early on partnering with Merida, manufacturing frames, assembly, and then bringing them back to the US. In fact, here at the Flandrian Hotel, we've got a first generation Specialized Alerts bike, which actually embodies that shift that Sinyard understood.
Absolutely.
You know, of course, there were in Australia, there were long established brands, you know, whether we're talking about Hillman or Cecil Walker at that time, or Ken Evans, equivalent certainly in other countries like the UK as well. And yet very few of those brands actually made the shift, you know, particularly towards composites. Well, why do you think that was the case? What sort of prevented those guys from actually doing what you did, which was understanding the shift, visiting Taiwan, looking at production opportunities?
I think in every business, irrespective of cycling or motor manufacturing or making shoes, there's a certain degree of inertia. People tend in any industry to stick with what they know because they've invested in it heavily, either in terms of capital equipment, you know, plant, personnel. They understand that business. I work a lot for Italian brands, but there's a tremendous amount of cultural history and about certain brands which they like to preserve, and that's very, very, very much. Going into composite was not only a new material, which very few people actually understood, but to set up a composite factory, manufacturing plant, and specifically cycling focused, takes a lot of money. So you're not just going to go and invest several million dollars in one anywhere in the world. You've got to do it because it's quite, and still is, after 20 odd years me being in it, still is relatively labor intensive. So one of the biggest costs in manufacturing with composite isn't the composite. It can be, depending on the grade you use, but the biggest single cost in most Asian-based composite factories is still labor. That's why there's been a gradual change as labor rates in China and electricity costs have gone through the roof. They're on par now almost with Taiwan. There's been this move by a lot of factories to lower cost, the lower labor cost countries like, you know, Cambodia, Vietnam, Myanmar. The major brands are always trying to chase the dollar. It's chasing the dollar.
Be interesting to just, I mean, clearly, you know, Legera was set up in the late 1990s, then you became Australia's first full composite bicycle company. And then in 2007, you decided yourself to relocate to Asia. What drove that decision and what did you learn in making the shift?
That's a very contentious issue. I'm happy to discuss it with you, but it's going to upset a few people. So I found it in the pronunciation, by the way, is Legera, Italian, Legera.
You have to understand, Paul, you know, that I'm Australian, so, you know, Italian English is my second language. So you've got to get me to pronounce Italian words and people can roll around on the floor, but I'll say Legera, all right? Sorry, just...
Right. You couldn't spell it. My mate, Michael Rogers,
speaks Italian fluently, so he's going to roll around the floor when he hears this interview. very good. But so we got the pronunciation out of the way. So tell me a little bit about that move. And so maybe just a quick summary. So you set up Legera, you started growing in Australia. How did the business go then in the early 2000s? And then what drove that shift to your physical location?
Okay. So I've started off out of a shed, So it's your classic Silicon Valley story. I'm basically buying and selling stuff out of my shed. And then one very fortuitous, very fortuitous day, a very, very talented ex-pro Australian who has since, unfortunately, 2 years ago passed away, a guy called John Cantwell, came back from Italy. He was a very, very good junior rider. He rode for, he went over to join the Australian Academy in Italy. Very promising guy, incredibly talented, good looking, could talk the talk, real ladies man, great guy. John and I just got on so well. So I found him working in a bike shop. He said, "What the hell are you doing back here?" Well, you know, it didn't work out for me in Europe. And I said, "Right, I've got a job. Do you want to be my sales manager for Australia?" Best decision I ever made. And together, so I employed John for many years, and we grew the brand together. Now, up until this time, everything was my money. I didn't have any bank loans or anything. I just put my own money into it. It was growing very strongly. I think you've heard the story that I soon realized, anybody that realizes, that when you're dealing in those days with Asia, the only way to ensure you're getting the product that you really want and your customer expects is to be here. Now, I was going through a divorce at the time in Australia, so it made sense to me to move to China, which I did in 2001. And I wanted to learn the art of composite from the ground up. So I went and literally lived in a dormitory, in a factory for the next 7 years. And I learned carbon engineering, not from a book, and not certainly not from a university undergraduate degree. I learned it from being in a Chinese factory and sweeping floors and doing layups and curing and cutting tooling and understanding all the things that can go wrong, because I was there 7 days a week for 7 years. And the brand, meanwhile, was growing. I was back in Australia on a break, and two clients of mine, who happened to be Kiwis, had bought bikes. And they approached me and wanted to invest in the business. They said, "Oh, you know, we love your bike. We've had everything. We've had this brand. We've had your bikes are the best. We want to invest in the business." Now, first time anybody would ever even consider it. And it was the worst decision of my life, because it ended up, they were basically crooks. And I invested in another brand, which you'll be familiar with, the Teschner brand. Peter Teschner had a bit of a name in the 80s and 90s in Australia for his alloy bikes. And I bought that company. Peter was basically bankrupt at that time. And I had a lot of respect for Peter at that time. But unfortunately, he also wasn't the bike genius that I thought he was. And in 2007, whilst I was in China growing the brand, by that time we were selling in the UK through Terry Dalton. We were selling in Asia, South Africa, blah, blah, blah. The brand was growing until one fateful day I got a phone call from the office back on the Gold Coast saying, "You need to come home and relocate to Australia because the company's bankrupt." And what they'd been doing was pulling money out of the business. And we were $500,000 in a hole. And they expected me to fill it. So the company, I decided not to reinvest in my own company. I left, and the company was basically one of the three. I won't mention who it was, but ended up in prison. The other two should have, but managed for whatever reason not to. They were investigated by ASIC and found to be, you know, they should have been struck off as directors. But anyway, I just decided to leave. So I came back to Asia, where I was immediately headhunted by another carbon factory up in Shum, which is a big hub of carbon manufacturing, and then I was a technical consultant. So I spent the next 7 years there as a technical consultant, bringing in new brands.
That must have been a huge shock. I mean, as an entrepreneur, as you said, I mean, you'd done extremely well working in the oil exploration business. I mean, you'd built up your company to be in a position where, you know, financially you were in a probably great place. And then, I mean, how old were you when this happened, Paul? I mean, essentially bankrupt, what, mid-40s, something like that?
No, I was like, 2007, so that's 13, 14 years ago, so I would have been 52. So yeah, I mean, it was the most devastating thing. I mean, the company was bankrupt. They weren't able to pay me or anything else, and they owed me a lot of money, which I never got. But it was more the shock of trusting people and having and put my faith in them. They were riding on my coattails. They did really, these two guys knew absolutely nothing about running any business, let alone a bicycle business. Teshner knew a little bit about Alan. Yeah. Unfortunately, Peter Teshner never made a bicycle.
You said during that time you had been in China yourself. So was it just the faith that your business partners had the skills and capabilities and that you were not as closely engaged perhaps operationally back in Australia as you
that was exactly right. My role in the company, I was obviously CEO of the company, but my role was technical engineer, making sure the product were designed, manufactured. We were constantly having new designs and we got product on time. Their sole role was to maintain a warehouse and make sure John Hamper was out doing his job and we were selling product. Mm. But what would happen is, you know, bills would come in and they'd just be put under a table because they were drawing money out of the business. And when I went back, as I say, it was $500,000. We should have been very profitable, judging by the amount of bikes we were selling. But they never paid the manufacturer of the frame.
Okay, so what advice would you give some, you know, because actually here at the Flandrian Hotel where we are running entrepreneurship programs, we have a lot of entrepreneurs coming in actually courses who are at that stage in their business where they're looking at growth. You know, they often start off a hobby business which becomes a more serious concern, and then they realize the need to scale. And that often does involve bringing in partners, whether on an operational level or financial level. So, you know, what lesson did you take away from that? And what advice would you give to people in finding those partners?
Well, first of all, it's very, very rare in my experience of over 40 years of doing this to ever find a successful partnership that started off with people being friends. It normally, money is the killer of relationships always. So that to me is always enough. You should not seek money unless it's, you know, close family. But, you know, look, there are examples of friends getting together, starting very successful business, but they generally end up when the companies are successful or gets into trouble, it's a blame game. So yes, you do need capital, and I've been very lucky. I didn't need it. I think the key component is you must, if it's your business, your idea, you must retain control. You must retain shareholder control, in other words, 51%. So you are in control. Most investors don't like that because it's their money and they feel they have a right to control it. But they miss the point. This is what happened in my case. These people had no clue about the ins and outs of the bicycle business. None of them. One was a backyard one or two frame a week guy who'd been making frames at a loss for 20 years, never made money, gave a lot of bikes and frames away to famous people because he wanted to be famous, but never made a cent. The other two were just a couple of circus clowns, basically. I don't know how they made money or even if they actually ever had money. They claim they did, but you know the Gold Coast.
For those people, that was an issue. And again, that's an issue of I've often seen it myself, is that when an entrepreneur is in that mode where they're so busy operationally, that when people do come along who they think might be a good fit, sometimes they do jump into relationships a bit too quickly. You know, they don't perhaps do the due diligence
you have to do your due diligence.
Competence, and that sounds like something which was the case for you. You know that you were.
I didn't do it. I should have done. I was too focused on keeping the business running. It was new to me because I've never had an investor in my life, and the thought of somebody just throwing money at it. Oh, this is great. And my ex-wife at the time said, "Just do it. What could go wrong? Look, use their money. What could go wrong? You're not here. Just let them run." And it seemed like a good idea at the time. But my strong advice to people is, first of all, check out who you're talking to. Do not accept money from close friends, because if it does go, wrong side up, you will be blamed, and they will, you know, you'll lose friendships over it. So just be careful.
So can you tell us, Paul, just in terms of where Legera is today? Because obviously, you know, you have rebuilt certainly the company, and not only that, you've also, you know, in a way diversified with the company. So can you maybe just give us a quick summary now of like what is the focus of Legera, and also perhaps talk to us a little bit about the other activities? Particularly, I'm very curious about what you're doing with LTI on the design consultancy side as well.
Okay, so the Legera brand as a bike was always owned by me, so that ceased to be when they went bankrupt. So there is no current Legera bike. When I came back as a consultant, my wife and I, I was married in 2007, I was married to a Taiwanese, we decided to carry on the name Legera Technologies, LTI is Legera Technologies International, because we brought through our visits to various trade shows over the year with Legera, we've made a network of people, including people like who you're familiar with, the owner of Ridley, and we've met various other brands over the years who'd actually seen our stuff and liked it. I could talk for hours about different people who approached me to sell them my bike, but I didn't want to do it. So anyway, when we came back, we decided we would set up a consultancy. I wasn't looking for a job. I was looking for a consultancy position, which this particular carbon factory agreed to on very, very lucrative terms, because they didn't have the expertise to know how to attract foreign brands into their unknown Chinese carbon factory, and they didn't know much about design. They were very good engineers, I have to say, but they produced a very good product, and they actually had a specific patent on how to cure a carbon bike, which nobody else had. They were the first. It's been widely copied now. It was patented, but it's been widely copied. It was that technology, which is the reason I went there. And again, I had 7 years there of building that factory from quite small to a mid-tier factory. And we were making for, you know, 15, 20 different leading European brands by the time I'd left. And we were doing frames, forks, and wheels. Brands you're very familiar with, obviously, not wishing to mention names, but we were doing some very.
It must have been, I guess, in terms of a time of in your life, Paul, because, I mean, this was a major shift which was happening within the industry, right? Because, of course, as you mentioned, with specialized driving, it suddenly. You had the European brands, you mentioned Ridley, but also eventually the Italians realizing that they simply could not compete in terms of the production, the quality, and the investments that they needed to make. And then we did see what seemed to be almost a stampede towards Asia. So as I understand it, your role there was in a way working between the factory and the brand. So you were the middle person in a way, speaking to the Europeans, the Americans, the Scandinavian company, what they needed and how they would.
Exactly. I was the point of contact. I mean, it could, depending on the brand, it could be as simple as, we need a new road bike. If you pick up the latest Tour magazine, if you look at page 73, there's an ad for a bike you kind of like the look of. Can you make us something like that? That's the simplest version. The other extreme is, here's a bunch of drawings. We've been to three other carbon factories to get quotes. What's your quote? The reason we were successful is that we provided more than just a manufacturing service. We actually had, because of my background, we had design input, because obviously I'm a Westerner. So I appreciated that there was, at that time, there was a huge difference. You could walk to any trade show and you'd go, that was designed by a Chinese, that was designed by a Taiwanese, that's an Italian bike, because they were so dissimilar in terms of quality of design. Not necessarily manufacturing, but it was quality of design. What I provided was more of a Western view of design. So I'm not a designer. I'm much more a composite engineer than I'm a designer, but I employ a lot of people that do. So Legera LTI provided those design services. We provide the link where they could call up 24/7, speak to an English speaking who actually knew what the difference between a press fit 30 and a BSA bottom bracket was. and, you know, trail angles and how they affect your steering. So, you know, it made it much easier because the, up until then, the typical link was a, in China, Chinese, educated in English language, but no knowledge of the bike industry. Everything was done by part numbers. Couldn't really understand what they were. It caused an immense amount of problems. As you know, in business, 95% of all problems are just communication.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was a communication, it was a communication link that made us successful. Because we, I've always said to people, like people on planes, like, what do you do? What do you do for a living? I'm in the customer service business. Oh, isn't everybody? I said, yeah, that's what everybody's in. What part of it is? Well, I design and manufacture composite high-end performance sporting components. But at the end of the day, I could make the best design bikes out of the lightest, best materials. But if I don't provide good customer service, I'm just as useless as the majority of people are. And that's how I view it.
It's over there. Yep. So I understand that. Obviously, I mean, you mentioned the evolution there of, you know, initially, of course, frames and components and wheels. And then I guess, you know, it was also while you were there, obviously, in Taiwan, then we also saw this amazing economic miracle happening in mainland China. And then increasingly also the rise of the Chinese-based specialist companies as well. So, I mean, where do you see now, given the dynamic and the way that the industry has evolved now, as you have described, you know, the full spectrum of some companies simply showing a photograph to a partner in Taiwan or mainland China and saying, we want something that looks like that, right through to some of the more, you know, specialized or high-end companies really working with you right through the whole design, conceptualization, manufacturing process. Where do you see the industry going forward from here? Because, you know, I had a curious conversation just a few weeks ago, actually, to a carbon company who are actually manufacturing frames again here in Belgium, in Leuven, because they're saying we've made big advances and we can actually now be...
You're talking about David Reinforced, who's a very good friend of mine, and I spend a lot of time in Leuven.
Absolutely. So where do you see things going now? You know, is it possible that we'll see a resurgence of Europe as a manufacturing base for carbon? Where do you see that sort of interaction between the manufacturers, the designers, because at the moment what you've been describing is that essentially the cycling industry has become in a way modularized, you know, companies specialized on certain parts of the value chain. Where do you see that going?
Well, it's a very interesting question, and there's no real one answer because it depends on what tier of manufacturing and brand recognition that you're looking at. You know, the bicycle industry, like all sporting industries, is, in fact, any industry has, you know, levels of tiers. Motoring industry, you know, you've got Porsche and Ferrari and Mercedes, and then you come down to Audis and then Volkswagen and BMW, whatever. So there's levels of tiers. And you've got the four top tiers, of, you know, obviously Giant's number one, Merida, Trek, Specialized, Fight It Out, number two and three. So they're pretty well looked after because they have invested in their own manufacturing and they're very happy with that. It works for them. They do design in-house. They don't go to guys like me. They don't need to. They've got hundreds of very talented engineers, plenty of them, and they're all in this endless battle at the HSB level, high street brand level, for market share. Anything one does, the next one's going to do. So you've just got this constant jockeying for position. Now, when it gets down to the level two and threes, there's a number of factors that come into play. When I went to China in the early 2000s, the business model then for composite manufacturing was everything was done in-house. You went to a factory, you had the design drawings done to create the CAD drawings into mold tooling, which was either done in that factory or was sent to a very close tooling shop. The carbon was brought in as a prepreg, it was laid up, it was cut, laid up, cured, sanded, bonded, sanded again, painted, finished, out the door. That model now is largely at the let's say level two, three and below. For various reasons, which we don't have time to go into, over the last 5 to 10 years, that model has also now almost disappeared. Not entirely, but it's much more, you're much more likely today to not actually know where your products are. You'll have a contract with Factory A. Factory A is subcontracting the sanding to Factory B. Factory B is subcontracting the painting to Factory C, because all of the labor costs have got so significant. And getting labor in China, believe it or not, a country of 1.5 billion people, is now becoming incredibly hard. Nobody wants to work in, white collar, blue collar industries. Making carbon fiber is a dirty business. It's, polluting and quite dangerous. So the outsourcing now has been what's happening in Asia, and the quality in many respects has gone down. Lead times have mushroomed. You as a brand are not always exactly sure. So when you make your annual trip to China and you go and see your factory supplier, they will bring everything back in-house for that visit and tell you that everything's being made in-house. But the reality is, it's not. And it's not all cases. I'm picking out specific. I'm not going to tell you specific brands who do this. But look, I suppose your listeners will say, does it matter? In many cases, it doesn't. But in some cases, it does. It matters in a very bad way. It can lead to some problems, because then if you do have an issue, it's the blame game. Who did this part? Who did that part? Who was actually responsible for this? Because these are usually smaller factories, and if there's a big recall, they disappear. They'll shut the doors and go.
So is that why, and again, if we talk about what's happening now in Belgium, with people pursuing actually production here, is that what's driving that? That's what's driving that, actually, these tier two and three companies realizing to ensure quality. Obviously, what is driving that, the rise? And maybe you can say a little bit about what's happening in Europe, because I guess many people are not aware that actually there are companies investing in bringing carbon frame production back into Europe, back into mainland Europe.
Yeah, well, look, composite production has always been in Europe. I mean, all look bikes are still made in Europe, and certain other brands still are. But there's always been a pricing premium, purely because of labour costs. That's the bottom line. It's been, because it's a labour-intensive process, you can't compete at a dollar-for-dollar level with Asia, because they're paying a tenth of the hourly rate that we're paying. Okay. So what's generally happened is most of the big companies have said, okay, how do we get rid of the factory I ran for 7 years, had at its peak nearly 1,000 workers. How do we get rid of 1,000 workers? Well, there are certain ways you can do semi-automation and certain things you can't. So we look at automation. Wheel rims are one example. You can semi-automate now. Not many companies have invested in the money, but the good ones, the ones I either have or use, contract to, use semi-automated or fully automated tape winding. There are reasons for that, technical, mechanical reasons for it. It's a better product. It gives you a more consistent thing. But above all, once you've done the capital investment, you can run that machine 24/7. It doesn't get pregnant. It doesn't go on golden week. It just runs and runs and runs. As long as you keep it greased and you keep the supply of raw material up to it, you go home at the weekend and keep working. So what's happened in Europe is that the technology to automate, and the company that we are now talking about specifically, I'll mention their name, Reinforce, they had a particular technology which is building a wire mesh into a composite, which gives very high impact resistance and tolerance. It does add a little bit of weight. However, it has numerous other benefits, but the technology to do it required significant investment, and that investment, because it wasn't in human power, it was in actual capital equipment, could be made in Belgium. Now, the reason to do it is that you've now shortened your supply chain to your major clients. Your major clients can actually get in the cars and come and see it when it's running, and you can offer a really boutique, customized service, level of service, which the customer is prepared to pay for. They're not making cheap Walmart bikes at Reinforce. They're making high quality, I think at the moment, mostly mountain bikes Absolutely. And they're excellent. You know, I know the guys, Dave Watson, I've worked together for 10 years, excellent company, and it just happens to be in Belgium. Yeah. But there are moves, I can't say too much because I'm involved in it, there are moves to open a carbon factory in England, for example. I'm involved in that at a very early stage at the moment. And if it's happening there, it's going to happen in Spain. I think it's already being done in Italy, but in a very small volume way.
Yep.
There are a number of very high quality. It's just they don't have the capacity. In China, you're talking, the factory can easily make, or one of the big guys can easily make, well, I'll give you an example. The biggest composite road or wheel manufacturer now makes 600,000 composite wheels a year. Now, that was unheard of when I was running the company. I know the owner, when he was still a shareholder in my company, we were doing 30,000. He's almost fully automated his factory, and he's doing 600,000. So his unit costs have come down, his quality's gone up. Why would you build a composite rim factory in Europe? You can't you can't compete.
So, that makes sense. I guess the other development, which is very interesting, again, I was chatting with Michael Rogers about this just a couple of weeks ago, is the whole rise of the 3D printer technologies. So we see now already that many of the teams are using 3D printed aero bars that are produced in very small. Where do you see that going, Paul? The whole additive manufacturing, 3D printing, kind of carbon stuff. Components. Right now, where do you see that in 3 to 5 years?
Yeah, right now the best guy in the world for that is Dimitris Katsanis, who's a member of NextGen. He prints all of INEOS team's bars out of his factory, Metron, in the UK. Dimitri used to be, as you probably know, head of the UCI Technical Committee. Dimitri and I have worked together for a number of years. The only problem with additive manufacturing at the moment is purely the capital equipment cost to set up a machine. Just recently, Dimitri invested in a new Scalm Alloy. It's a new aluminium-based alloy that's just been certified by the FIA for Formula One use. So Dimitri started off in all his current bars were all made out of the titanium. They're powdered titanium, created layer upon layer upon layer, and then polished. So you can create anything. But the capital equipment cost for that machine is something like $500,000 or pounds, I can't remember. The Scalm Alloy one is probably even more. So you've got a massive capital equipment outlay, and you've got to have enough customers to justify it. You need to run those machines 24/7. Now, the advantage is that you can create incredibly complex shapes that you can't either do with CNC or creating composite. So, you know, you're able to get incredible stiffness to weight ratios, but they are expensive. Now, additive, one of the things I'm also involved in now is bringing a lot more additive manufacturing in the forms of, you mentioned 3D printed. It's a slightly different technique. Everybody's now familiar with little machines that go around and lay a track of melted thermoplastic or not. We're doing a lot of that now in a couple of components for the helmets and the saddles. And I can't say too much because they'll be hitting the market in the next few months. But technology, we're entering, and this is what gets me up every morning. There are a number of new avenues for people like me, material scientists, to go back and try to exploit the weaknesses of carbon composites, which are the mainstay of the cycling industry today. It's a fantastic product. It's lasted, obviously had the test of time. But there are newer materials, better materials when used, and you can target specific materials to do a slightly better job, but in some cases, a demonstrably better job. Now, that takes time, investment, money. And we get back to the inertia thing. Many of the companies, many of the brands don't really want to do it because they see it adding cost. So they don't want to be first to market if it adds price. Because then it'll be, oh, that's a nice bike, but it's $200 more than the equivalent brand X, so I won't buy it. Oh, but it's got all these technical features. But I can't see them. you know, you're telling me they're in there, but I can't see them, so how do I know? This is what happened to graphene back in 2010. It was the new name that all the marketing guys got hold of, and what they were doing wasn't graphene, it was rubbish. It was just powdered graphite, and it destroyed the name. The graphene is coming. You believe you me, by 2025, you won't be able to buy a sporting product that doesn't have graphene in it.
Excellent. I'm just sorry about that. I had a bit of a technical glitch. So, I mean, it's fascinating how it's evolving. And at the same time, I guess the one of the challenges here, and again, when I was talking to Michael at the UCI about this, is you know, one of the biggest, of course, issues always has been, you know, and certainly the rise of Taiwan and China, was ensuring that safety standards were being followed and that the products were compliant with whether it's North American or European safety standards. Yeah. How on earth does a body like the UCI, you know, put in place policies or approaches to ensure that something which is made in somebody's, you know, garage is compliant?
Well, look, we all are supposed to meet certain international standards. The current one used to be an EN standard, now it's all gone to ISO, International Standards Organization. So there are such standards. When you're dealing with the reputable companies, the only way you can do it is, what generally happens is, let's take a new product for 2022. Engineer will design it, we'll come over to China, we'll do the layups, we'll open molds, we'll create them all, we'll do a tooling, and there's an awful lot of experience goes into where the composite goes, the greater composite, and more specifically the angles of the layups, how thick they are. And we've got to ensure no delamination errors, all that sort of stuff. So once that first prototype sample is made, one goes off to the excuse me, I must be in a bit of a dust. Anyway, the one sample usually goes to the customer, just so he can build a bike out of it and make sure he likes it and do all the artwork. And the other one goes into a testing lab, generally in the factory that's created it. Most of the factories, well, all the factories I work have full, every piece of equipment that I can thoroughly examine according to different ISO standards. Now, if that matches, the factory itself will issue a certificate that says this particular bike exceeds ISO or meets minimum ISO requirements. Now, the bigger brands will tend to then go and get it to an independent testing authority, like the big one is SGS, there are others, who will then run their tests and either give it a certificate as well. So you've got a double, you know, you've got double proof. That's all fine and well good. Trouble becomes when you then go into volume production. As Elon Musk famously said, making a sample of a prototype is easy. Any idiot can do that. Trying to make 100,000 of them that are all perfect is a nightmare. That's what I do every day. And you've got to be able to make sure that the quality standard does not vary, because the number of variables is almost infinite. You know, you could literally, and I've seen this many, many years ago, I had experience. We were making frames that were great, and they were bonded. It was a bonded frame, it wasn't Monaco, it was a bonded frame. And in that particular factory, it was Friday evening, we'd made a whole production batch, and a huge thunderstorm came over, and the workers all went home for the weekend, and a pot of bonding adhesive was not sealed and put back in the correct storage. It was left open. Monday morning, came to work, bonded another couple of hundred frames. Every one of them, by the time they got to within 3 months of being purchased, broke at the same point. Yeah. Now, we were just aghast. What was going on? We tracked it all back, and we found out that particular tub of adhesive was hydroscopic. It had absorbed the moisture over the weekend from this big rainstorm and was effectively useless. But because we didn't do 100% batch testing, it wasn't picked up. First of all, you know, you get the standard, all your customers know, you get the standard hairline crack in a frame. You take it back to the bike shop and they go, oh, it's just cosmetic, it's okay. But in our case, it was actually debonding. So tiny things like that can have a big effect. You've got a machine operator who does a job, and suddenly, you know, he doesn't turn up to work, so they give somebody else the job, and he doesn't do it the same way, causes a problem. So, yeah, it's complicated.
I guess that puts a lot, you know, for those people who believe that, you know, within a couple of years, people will be, you know, manufacturing components using, you know, 3D printers at home and then using them in competition or races. You know, I guess that's still very, very questionable because of some of the reasons you're talking about. I mean, how on earth does a product actually go from somebody's literally their kitchen into UCI level competition without safety testing? Very, very tricky question, indeed, I guess. I mean, Paul, you're good. I'm just aware of the time now. I mean, we've been chatting away. What are you most excited about? So if you think about the next, say, 3 to 5 years in the industry, obviously you've already touched upon, you know, the possibility of carbon factories opening in the UK or here in Belgium. You know, you've talked about additive engineering. I mean, what most excites you when you think of that next generation?
It's going to be a combination of several things. It'll be definitely the rise of graphene right now, pure proper graphene. It's now been properly termed, you know, it's now an ISO standard for real graphene. So I just wish the marketing guys would just back off and stop calling everything that's black powder graphene, because it's not. But real graphene, two-dimensional graphene, but the price has come down astronomically as more and more producers have come into the field. We're using it in a number of products now, but you will start seeing it properly used, not just in a marketing sense, but, you know, real engineers using it where it's needed, what it can do, that it can do so many things, it's unbelievable. So you're going to see the rise of graphene. You will ultimately see the rise of additive manufacturing, 3D printing, as the cost of the machinery and processing. 10 years ago, if you bought a 3D printer, it cost you $10,000. Now you can buy it for $300. So it's the costs are coming down. There's more of them as technology does. But don't discount the fact that you could 3D, you could additive manufacture, effectively 3D print some of it in somebody's machine shop, and it would and it could go and win the Tour de France. I don't doubt that is going to happen, because I'm seeing parts of it, the bike already done. As I say, what Dimitri does, he does it all day long. We were joking the other day that he's only got 99 world championships or gold medals at Olympics, only 99. And our team is all joking that until he gets 100, don't brag, you know. So,
We were talking to Ramon van Stralen at Bio Racer, so I think he still has quite a few to go to catch up to Ramon at Bio Racer, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, these guys are out there, and they're all guys like me, but we're in the shadows, you know. We're the guys behind the guys, but, you know, I've never professed to be a good bike rider, but I know my composite business, and I run a successful, well, I've got five companies, but I run, they're all successful, because we, you know, we're experts at what we do. We work with the best people. But just to come back to your point, I think, you know, it's a highly competitive industry, just as most industries are. If you look at Nike, Adidas, Puma, and all the rest, they're in a battle every day. One guy makes a breakthrough, everybody tries to do theirs, try to catch up. That's how the industry works. But there is always a certain degree of built-in redundancy. I've said this before, you know, the bikes that we see, the trade shows, the Eurobikes, the Type A shows, they're last year's models already. They haven't been into the public view yet, but I'm working on bikes now for 2025, which are, you know, using materials you've never heard of. They still look like a bike, but they'll be, you know, demonstrably stiffer, lighter, et cetera, et cetera. So, of course, we can't forget e-bikes, the big, you know, revelation of the COVID thing. I've never done an e-bike until 3 years ago. Now 50% of my staff, my engineers, were all working on e-bikes. So it's very hard to predict, but what is certain is that certain aspects of high-end racing, mountain bikes, et cetera, bikes, will be relocated back to Europe. They will never be at the cheap end. of the market. These will always be a premium product, but the lead times will probably be reasonably shorter. The cost will not be low, but they will be a quality premium product. That's not to say that everything out of China is not a quality premium product. You've got to know who you're using, you know, what the reputation of the company is, and you've really got to be there to monitor it. And that's what another one of my companies, we have QC managers in China, which I've either trained or, you know, came with 20 years experience. All they do all day long is fly around China going to factories, checking not just the final product. It's too late to do anything in there. No point looking at 95. You've got to check the quality of the materials that comes in the door, how it's cured, the oven temperatures, you know, all those things. And then you go back again and you check it the next day. And you go back again after it's been painted. So that's what we'll do.
I just say, wow, great. Thanks a lot. That's fascinating. Well, you know, last question for you, Paul, because I mean, you're still going strong at a time when many people are thinking about retirement. So, you know, what is it that
play golf?
That's exactly. My business partner is the incredible, energetic Bernard Muttermann, who's started this new business at the age of 63, which I think is just fantastic, and it's great working. And what is it you think that as an entrepreneur in their 60s, what is it that keeps driving you and keeps you motivated, gets you up in the morning?
It's the challenge of proving people wrong when they say you can't do that. It purely is. And around about this time, it's getting early evening in Taiwan. Around about this time, three times a week, we have team meetings of 26, depending on which team they're in, with NextGen, of the most highly respected engineers, material scientists, designers around the world. And it's just like sitting around a coffee club after a good, hard training session. You're just in that atmosphere of talking to people who really know what they're talking about, who are quite happy to share the information because they have a passion. I still have a real passion for cycling, even though I don't cycle anymore for various health reasons, but I'm among a group of people who do. So I'm in that industry. So I would never retire. My hobby is I ride big road motorbikes and I race a bit, so that's my hobby. But what gets me up every morning is the challenge of looking at an idea and saying, can this in any way, shape or form be done? And hopefully going back to a client and saying, you've had so many people say it can't be done, but we think we can do it, and we can do it. And that's what motivates me. I'm not interested in just doing cookie cutter, you know, who can make the cheapest carbon wheel? Who can have the cheapest, you know, wheel brand? It doesn't interest me. It's just the rubbish end of the market. And there's plenty of people who can do it, and there's a need for it. Of course there is. You know, Walmart in America sell a lot of bikes. Kids buy them, and that's fantastic. Somebody's got to make them. It just doesn't happen to be, you know, that doesn't mean it's a bad thing. It's not what gets me off. I like the science, I like the engineering, and specifically I like the material science of it.
Paul, it's been brilliant. Thanks a lot. For those of you watching this video, I hope you've enjoyed our discussion with Paul Farrell, one of the real innovators, someone who's been working behind the scenes of the cycling industry for decades, and is probably one of the most insightful and knowledgeable people in the industry. So if you've liked this video, please do give us the thumbs up. And Paul Farrell, thanks again for your time. We'd love to have you on the show again sometime in the future. Thanks, Paul.